people weren't really doing newsletters so much back then. Where did it come from?
Can I swear on this?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Kind of came into work every day and like fucked around.
Where are these 23,000 people coming from?
I was doxxed by 8chan. I was like, this is wild. Those are weeks when I don't sleep a lot.
I've never heard of anybody doing that.
That pissed me off so much. I was like, you don't know about me. You don't know how this newsletter started. God, I hate hearing myself use the term content. I do not like the term content. I hate the term creator.
Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. Our guest today is Caitlin Dewey, a journalist with bylines in outlets like The New York Times, The Guardian, The Cut, Slate, Buffalo News, and The Washington Post, where she was the first to hold a digital culture critic role. We're talking today, though, because she's the creator of the perfectly titled newsletter, Links I Would G-Chat You If We Were Friends. She's been doing the newsletter for a decade, since G-Chat was actually a thing, but she did take a few years off in the middle. And this year, she's been working on making it her main gig. Let's start, though, with that Washington Post bit. So you were at the Washington Post for 6 years, for the first 2 years as a social media reporter, then as the digital culture critic, and then the final two reporting on food policy. Which beat was your favorite there?
First up, Francis, you know me better than I know myself. Thank
That's
you.
That's my job.
That's a good question. I mean, I think probably Digital Culture Critic was my favorite, right? There were a lot of bad things that happened during that time. I was doxxed by 8chan, things of that nature that sort of, in hindsight, shadowed the experience for me. But it was a fun beat, right?
Yeah.
And I've come back to it now. So, you know, everything comes full circle.
Mm-hmm. How did you, like... What were like the editorial decisions you guys were making when you started in that role, like defining that beat, how you talked about it, etc.? Like, how did you form that?
I wish I could tell you that there was a lot of strategy and thoughtfulness there. And I imagine that there is now in similar roles. But at the time, like very much dating myself, and this seems very naive, like the notion of covering digital culture as a beat at all was like very novel and revolutionary. So, I kind of came into work every day. Can I swear on this?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Kind of came into work every day and like fucked around. Like, it's like, I read the internet all morning. Here are three things that seem interesting. And my editor would be like, yeah, no. And we'd go from there. I can't claim that there was like a unified theory of digital culture behind it. I will say I never wanted to cover things that were trending for 5 minutes and then would never matter again. Like, I generally speaking gravitated towards stories that I thought said something bigger.
The life cycle was kind of longer on any given thing on the internet back then, right? It was like 10 years ago.
It's true. Yeah, probably true. And it's like, one day as opposed to 1 hour. But I wanted things that like would matter for more than one day, right? Like, if I chose to sink a lot of time into something, I'm like, this should say something bigger about like society or communication or the culture, whatever. So I think insofar as I had a strategy, that was it.
Yeah. Okay. So this is when you started the newsletter. You started the newsletter like right before you started doing the digital culture beat. Why did you start it? Where, like, people weren't really doing newsletters so much back then. Where did it come from?
Francis, do you remember Tiny Letter?
I barely do, but I do.
Tiny Letter before your time.
It was before I was newsletting, at least.
Yeah. So I would say that was a sort of the cusp of like the first newsletter boom, right? It was it was Tiny Letter. It was like Ann Friedman. Today in Tabs was their own back then. At the time, I was just spending like many hours every workday reading the internet. And at some point, I was like, it's kind of a waste of time that I do all this reading and nothing ever becomes useful. So I had a very cool, chill boss, and he agreed that I could also work on this personal newsletter during work hours. And I launched on Tiny Letter. It was very casual. If you had told me that newsletter would end up being my job, I would actually laugh in your face. But here we are.
Well, and you were doing it. I mean, so it sounds like it was kind of a side effect of your job, where it's like almost like notes for your main job, where you're like recording, like, maybe this thing is cool. I'm still thinking about this. I want to, like, you know, write it down somewhere, right?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, I had developed this like very sophisticated RSS feed infrastructure, right?
Yes.
Like, I had honed it over years. And so I was encountering a lot of cool stuff that way. And I was, in fact, G-chatting it to my friends. But I'm like, there has to be like a more useful way to turn this time and this work into something. And so that was the time.
Yeah. So are you still using like a curated RSS feed, or is that still part of your process?
The RSS feed is my number one portal to the internet. Mm-hmm. I never like switched to making social my main way of news or information consumption. And I'm glad I didn't, since that does seem to have collapsed.
Yeah.
As a reliable news and information source, I'm absolutely devoted to my RSS feed reader. I have put more than a decade into it. So.
That's amazing. Okay, I think for the listeners, we should describe what the structure of the newsletter was back then quickly. So I went back. I would say that like it's a quick intro, maybe three links, each one with a couple sentences of context, a little postscript, and that's it. And each issue is like 300, 400 words. And that's really it. Is that fair to say?
And it came out daily. Yeah.
Yes, it came out daily. Okay. So this is just like, was this like every lunchtime at work? You're like sitting down and like, oh, let me, what did I read today? Let me put it out.
Basically, yeah. I think I did it in less than an hour every day, which I, you know, envy my own youth. That will never happen again.
Okay. So you started at the beginning of 2014. And then I don't know if I'm like missing part of the archive, but I was scrolling back through your Substack archive. And if the last issue I could see before you stopped for a few years is November 2nd, 2016. It's a guide on how to safeguard your sanity in the last days of the election. You know, some things change, everything else stays the same, et cetera. There was no note though about like, this is it. It was, you literally said somewhere in it, like, see you next week. Why did you stop?
Yeah, this is by no means best practices for newsletter management. By all appearances, it looks like I stopped because of the 2016 election. That is not the case. I actually got a new job. So I switched beats at the Post and
to food policy.
This is ridiculous. I've switched to food policy. And for a while, I did plan to write length on my new beat. I'm like almost embarrassed to admit this. This is a real idea that I had. I was going to get a designer to make me a new logo. It said, that would say links are GTA you for your friends, but it would have like sausages or something on it. Oh, so it's good. Like, this is about food policy now.
Mm-hmm. You could have designed the newsletter like it was a menu at a restaurant, maybe.
If you get one section at the
appetizer,
time,
starter,
we would have got
dessert.
It off the ground.
Yeah. If only.
That actually really would have worked. So I had every intention of doing that, and then I just didn't, and years passed, and I'm like, well, this is embarrassing. It's too late to say anything now. So, yeah, I essentially abandoned it for almost 4 years.
Almost 4 years. And then 2020, you start it again, which my impression is it's like a typical, you know, pandemic. What am I doing in my life? I've got too much time on my hands. There's this thing I used to do. Let's start it again, right?
Very much so. And I was furloughed. So by that point, I had switched jobs. I was working in local news. I went back to my hometown paper. Mm-hmm. And kind of the instant they announced furloughs, I was like, I'm going to take a hard look at my life. Yeah.
I also got furloughed at this time. So I feel you.
I'm sorry to hear that. Oh, and you're in New York as well, right? So you dealt with the unemployment system.
Yes. Yeah. It took 2 months, I think, for me to get a check.
I didn't even get my full unemployment from New York State, and again, rather like I just gave up on the newsletter at some point. I was like, I'm done, I'm out, I'm moving on to the next thing. I will never see that $500.
Is what it is. Okay, so you start doing it again then in much the same format that you were doing it in the first iteration, and it kind of, I don't know, almost slowly you start to do more, and then just less than a year ago, so you I think this May, right? May 1st, you'd been doing it for now like 2.5 years again or something like that. And you did this rebrand, so you introduced paid subscriptions, et cetera. But I think this kind of like, there's one more event before that where you kind of, I think about a year ago, you decided to start. I don't know if this was, did you decide to start doing the newsletter full time, or was it like leaving a job? I think that's like the relevant event before the rebrand, right?
Yeah, it's been almost exactly a year since I left my job in local news. October 6th of last year, I left. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, so then was it like, were you diving directly into the newsletter, or what was the decision there?
Yeah, Francis, I'd be really keen to with you. When I left my job, I had a very regimented week-by-week plan. The newsletter was supposed to relaunch on December 1st. And then I had a miscarriage. It was my third in a row. It was absolutely devastating. I've written about it a lot in the newsletter. And I essentially didn't really work for 3 months. Like, I just like slept a lot and felt bad for myself, which is not the way anyone wants to start out their like freelance or like solopreneur.
Yeah. Seems ridiculous even to use that word, solopreneur, in the light of like that kind of event.
It's mortifying. I have to put it in quotes every time. So I'm glad there's a video element to this. So that was really scary, right? Like, I had just walked away from a regular paycheck. I had just walked away from excellent health insurance. The one advantage of local news, like Union Shop, I had amazing health insurance, which I had given up. So that was a huge roadblock and a huge challenge. But I stayed the course. I did get that plan back on track just months after I expected, and ended up launching at May 1st, as you said.
Yeah, well, I mean, impressive. So the May 1st launch, it leads to two issues now instead of like one and then sometimes another one a week. A beautiful redesign. You've got this great like kind of logo and like cohesive brand now. And then the paid subscription. So tell me about like the preparations. Like, once you're back on track and you're planning for this, what's going through your mind? What are you researching? What's inspiring you in terms of like other models you're trying to emulate? What were you thinking about leading up to the rebrand?
Yeah, so I could only term like an obsessive amount of research and planning for the relaunch. I had like tremendous anxiety about it being a failure. So my type A way of dealing with that was like planning out every little detail. It helped, right? So the one thing that I think I found most instructive for me was, you know, I surveyed my existing readers, which is common practice, common advice
for doing this type of rebrand. At the time, it was like 15,000 or so that you had.
It was probably less than actually. It was probably somewhere in between like 13 and 15,000. I surveyed my existing readers, but then more importantly, I did one-on-one video calls with, I think, probably about 3 dozen of people who responded to the survey. And I tried to pick a good cross-section of people, right? Like, people who were super fans, people who were like, I'm kind of into this newsletter, but would never pay for it.
People who'd opened one issue.
I don't think I talked to any of those people.
That would be maybe most of the time.
Mostly because I'm not sure I could get them on the phone, right? Like, they don't care. But those were so valuable to me because, I mean, you know this. When you write a newsletter, even if you have like a really good engaged audience, you are essentially writing into the void every week. Like, you do not know who is on the other end. And being able to get to know people on that like one-on-one friend basis, like in the name, and just find out like, who are they? Like, what do they do for work? Where do they live? What are they interested in? That really helped me inform the changes that I made to the newsletter.
Nice. Yeah, that's, I mean, I definitely know the writing into the void thing, which I should say too, like, this interview came about because you replied to the welcome email for Creator Spotlight when you signed up, which I always appreciate so much because it's insane how few reply. I mean, I don't comment. I don't really, if I'm like reading an article on the web, I don't really comment on it anyways. So like, you know, those who live in glass houses, throw stones, etc. I do want to know more though about your relationship to the audience and how that's changed over the years. Cause I bet like at the very beginning, it's, you know, probably like just your friends and like colleagues and stuff 10 years ago. And now it's, you know, like 20,000 people. So yeah, tell me about relationship with the audience, how it was 10 years ago and how that's shifted to now.
To some extent, I mean, you're right. It has completely changed in that it began as my literal friends and friends of my friends, right? So people just outside my social circle, and now it's needless to say not that, but also like my orientation to my audience over that time is, God, even saying audience, I'm like, I don't want to refer to them in that way. Readers, my relationship, my orientation to readers has like not really changed over that time. I think that just has so much to do with who I am as a person and what my goals for this newsletter were. Like, I never set out to create, nor do I have a media empire, nor do I have any interest in it, right? Like, I always just, my goals are small. Like, I want to write an interesting thing that brightens other people's day in some way. And also, like, I am a very friendly person who likes to engage and learn about other people. So I cannot have one-to-one relationships with 23,000 people, like regrettably. That would be awesome. But like I try to approximate that as best I can, right? So like the most fundamental level, like if you send me an email, I very much try to write back, right? Mm-hmm. But there's also some things I started doing when I launched paid subscriptions, which have been quite laborious, but like to me are the most important stuff that I do. So like if you buy a paid subscription to Links and you give me your birthday and your email address, I send you a handwritten thank you note with a sticker. I love it. But that's like how I was raised, right? That you send people thank you notes. So it's like, I'm just going to keep doing that through this business endeavor. And then on your birthday, I send an e-card with like a random fun link from I have like a folder of links that I save
your
for
bag
birthdays.
Of links.
Exactly. And I also started an Instagram account that essentially the sole purpose of it was to follow my readers back. Just to like introduce like a little more like equality to this weird relationship where like I'm always talking to you, but like you never talk to me.
That's so I feel like I've never heard of anybody doing that, because that's such a like that really does like make it less one sided. I feel like that's such like a level of, you know, audience reader engagement. I've never heard of that. That's so cool.
But like it's not strategic, right? It's not intended as an engagement strategy. Yeah. It's just like, I'm like, this is weird. Let's make it less weird. You know, like, you know, all about my life. I also want to like casually heart pictures of like your kids on their first day of school. Right.
Make it a two-way parasocial relationship.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm looking for in my life. I don't know. That's like a very long answer to your question. I remember like Links was referenced in a Cut article about newsletters once, and they were making fun of the notion or like the conceit that newsletter writers try to evoke this like fake friendliness with their readers. And that pissed me off so much. I was like, you don't know about me. You don't know how this newsletter started. I was writing to my friends. And like, why should I change now? You know? And that is the orientation I try to bring to it, generally speaking. I also just don't have the brain to be like more strategic about it, which is probably coming across.
No. I mean, but it's the authenticity and like your voice in it that is like not, I don't know, contrived. Okay. Talk a little bit about like the newsletter as a business. You said, I think this was, I'm going to reference this interview you did with Ethan Sawyer, his Human Pursuits newsletter, a few times. There's some great stuff in there. But I think it was in there that you said, oh no, this wasn't in that one, though. I'm going to come back to that later. 3 months after you did the relaunch, you said that you'd replaced roughly 40% of your previous local news salary with subscription revenue. That was now 2 months ago. Has it held steady? Has it gone up? Has it gone down? How is that going?
It's over half now. I'm happy to say. Nice. It's going great. That has been, I told you I'm type A. So like I've had forecasts and like goals I needed to meet, and I set the absolute minimum, for my own sanity. And so far, like exceeding that,
has
just been so gratifying and rewarding. Yeah.
You said you've
people have been super
half.
Generous. A little bit over half. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. That's so cool. Is the subscription revenue the only way you're monetizing, or I don't think I've seen any ads or anything.
Yeah. So I'm tiptoeing into ads. I am working on a sort of tentative trial basis with an ad sales guy to see if that is a good vehicle for Links. I think I'm going to be extremely picky about ads, so that might be difficult for me, but I think it makes sense no matter what medium you're in to diversify your revenue streams, right? I know some people are making it work just off subscription or membership revenue, and like God bless. Again, I just came out of the local news industry. I want to be as safe as possible.
Yeah. Okay. So this is something we have to talk about. The relationship between a creator and a journalist. Some of the people I talk to are like definitely more just creators, or not even, that might be the wrong way to say it. Some people I talked to were never professional journalists. Others, you know, were. And it's kind of a strange relationship. How do you define creator? What is a creator, first off? And then I'll tell you my definition, but I want to hear yours first.
I feel like creator is a euphemism made up by tech companies for people who labor in service of their platforms. I hate the term creator. I do. I don't use it if I can avoid it.
In much the same way you said, when I asked Ryan Broderick, he said a creator is an Uber driver for posts.
That's so good.
Yeah.
That is absolutely correct. Yeah.
The way I've been defining it is basically like, it's slippery. It's a two umbrella, whatever. But like the simplest way I've kind of landed on is like, it's somebody who is producing content online, not for like an organization, for themselves, and with an eye to an audience beyond their immediate friends and family. So, I mean, that was kind of a long way to say it, but just somebody who's creating content intending for it to reach an audience of people they don't know in real life, right?
I think that's excellent. That sounds textbook to me.
Okay, but the relationship between a creator and a journalist, I think one thing that I think about a lot between those two is that like journalists have, you know, codes of ethics and like ways of doing things, where I think creators who don't come from that background don't. And I think there's kind of this clash here too, which another part of it is like, it's a class in any creative industry, right? There's like the people who are good at creative stuff, the people who are good at business stuff, people who are good at both. Most people are not good at both. And I think most people I talk to are better at the creative side than the business side. And this is kind of what you're coming up against here too. I think this was when you were talking to Ethan Sawyer. You said something, yeah. You said, if I wanted to promote a brand, I would not have gone into public relations. I'm not like that. I'm just going to do the thing and people either find it or they won't. And I think this is the problem with like being an indie newsletterist or a creator, is that you butt up against this. So I don't know. How are you like breaking through that like journalist brain into like, cause you kind of have to, right? To make this sustainable, you have to like step into this side that you never intended to set into. Yeah.
Yes and no. I think what I was probably attempting to get at in that quote with Ethan is that my approach is very much like conventional journalistic-y. I am not doing the things that would lead to the newsletter growing most quickly or like most reliably, right? I mean, sort of best practices are I should be all over new Substack notes. I should be all over their new video features. I should be posting like TikTok summaries of my newsletter, like getting ready videos where I also talk about digital culture. Friends, you will never see me doing those things.
Look,
because they're not in my wheelhouse. I'm not good at them.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do it. So I know that there is this perceived tension between quote unquote content creators and journalists. It's not tension I feel myself. Like I admire those people for what they do. I think what they do is work and it is difficult and it has an important role in the culture, in the information ecosystem. But it's not the same as what I do. Like I don't feel I'm competing with them, right? I just did this session at the Online News Association conference, teaching people how to be quote unquote creator journalist. That was not my choice of term, right? I had three brilliant, excellent co-presenters, and creator journalist was their term, right?
Who are these other ones?
So it is my good friend Ryan Kellett, who is a Nieman Fellow at Harvard right now, and Liz Kelly Nelson and Blair Hickman, who are both former audience folks at Vox, who are consultants now. But you know, I remember the first call with them kind of being like, I don't call myself a creator journalist. I don't like this creator journalist. But ultimately, like we, are all powerless against larger trends in language. So, but I see myself as just being a journalist who has a newsletter. Like the newsletter is a platform. It's not an identity, you know?
Yes. Yeah. No, that makes complete sense. I want to linger on this, the Online News Association conference, for a little bit. What like what else was going on? What did you take? What was in the air? What were people talking about? Yeah. What did you take away?
Great question. This will actually be the subject of today's newsletter. So thank you for asking. People are talking about AI a whole lot, mm-hmm. a whole lot, to an extent that I increasingly found comical and absurd. I was also acquainted, and by the way, I'm telling you like the funny, silly things out of the conference, not the substantive stuff.
Please.
But journalists love free shit, right? Probably more than any profession on earth. So the swag was next level. But one item in particular was a must-have. People were obsessed with it. A
subscription to ChatGPT.
I don't know if that would have been better or worse. It was a black canvas tote bag that said, media literacy is sexy.
Uh-huh.
And it was being distributed by the first news-based dating app.
Oh, wow. That's going to be big in Park Slope.
Shut up. It's only launched in D.C., which tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Did the swag, was like that the bag that the swag came in?
No, each of the vendors like distributed their swag individually. But I talked to the founder of this app because I was like, what in the world? You know, I run a digital culture newsletter. Yeah. I want to know about the news-based dating app. And he told me that he went through hundreds of bags in the first day of the conference and was overnighting more media literacy is sexy swag for $500.
That's insane.
Ridiculous.
Well, we'll see if I hope his app makes $500. Anyways, okay, going back to your conversation with Ethan Sawyer, you said that your husband Jason was helping out with the newsletter. Is that still a thing? Like, what are you delegating?
No, I fired him. I don't know if I told Ethan
said this
that.
Is on social. He was helping with social, which you recognize that you need to do, but you really don't want to.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? I think Jason is struggling to keep up with it too.
Yeah. It's hard. It's really hard.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. We've like sort of talked about like what is the threshold at which we maybe consider bringing someone on like a couple hours a week basis, but I'm like I'm not there yet. And as I said, I don't have this like an appetite to expand beyond what I can do myself.
What are the ambitions? Like, do you have specific goals in terms of like an audience? It sounds like it's not like an audience size. I mean, it sounds like maybe monetization. It's like replacing that salary that you had at the Buffalo News. What are the specific goals? And then like also maybe more long-term fantastical, that would be nice, dreams.
So one of my co-presenters said this at our workshop on Saturday. She was quoting someone else, so I wish I remember the original source. But this person said, like, you need to decide from the jump if you are building a lifestyle or an empire. I thought that was such a good distinction. I am absolutely building a lifestyle. I want to, you know, be comfortable, pay my mortgage, pay my bills. I want to be doing writing that feels intellectually and creatively fulfilling to me. And, you know, I want to be able to like travel a little bit or something, right? Yeah. But like beyond that, I'm good, right?
Yeah, I respect that.
So I don't have, like there aren't audience numbers I need to hit to feel like I'm successful. I do have KPIs. I don't know if I mentioned that interview with Ethan, but Jason is a project manager. So project management brain has filtered into my workflow. So my like quote unquote key performance indicators aren't just things like how many readers I have. It's how many weeks paid vacation did I take this year? And it's things like, how many not just any freelance assignment, but how many like interesting, fulfilling freelance assignments did I get off the newsletter this quarter? So I'm trying to look at this more holistically. Like it is not about like money or like numbers to me. Like,
well, it's more about
fulfillment.
When I talked to Kate Lindsay, who runs Embedded, She's very explicitly told me how much money she's making doing this. I think she's the only person who's ever done that. But she was like, well, I make anywhere between $1,500 to $3,000 a month through subscriptions. But like for her, it's like, it's a calling card for, yeah, for freelance gigs. I've talked to people too who like they made a newsletter as a way of breaking into a field. Like this woman, Ariel Nissenblatt, she wanted to get into podcasting. So she started a newsletter where she like, round up like five podcast episodes every week. And then now she like works at Descript as in like podcast community there. So it's like, I think that to me is like almost a more sustainable story, like for the mass of people, for the majority of people who like want to have a newsletter it, with whatever that means. Right. I think like it being a brick in a larger wall of your life is like more sustainable than like, and more realistic than like, I want to have a media empire. Only a few people are going to get to that media empire level. Right.
Absolutely. I mean, it goes back to the whole theory of like 100 true fans or 1,000 true fans. Do you remember that?
Like a, you need 1,000
Wired
like
article in the 90s.
Yeah,
exactly. So it's like many people can build like a comfortable middle class lifestyle off of a small audience.
Yes.
So bring back really, you're just running into trouble when you're bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, bring back, you know, industry to towns like Buffalo, good middle class industrial newsletter jobs.
Okay. I mean, you're not wrong, though. Like in Buffalo, if you want to work in journalism, your options are the Buffalo News, which just announced yesterday they're cutting 5 more staff newsroom jobs.
Which that's where you were before.
That's where I was before. Or you write for yourself. Like there are no. Or you're on TV, but that's like a whole game, different game entirely, right? Like, there is no alternative media here. There are no independent media here. So this style of working is extremely powerful for people who live in parts of the country like this, which is most of the country, right?
Yeah. You don't have to live in a big city to do newsletter. How much time do you spend on it each week? And then, two part. How much time do you think you're spending, and what percentage of that is like the writing and the research versus more admin type of stuff?
Yeah, so I'm actually quite a slow writer to my own detriment. So I probably spend two and a half work days just writing the newsletter, researching and writing the newsletter. And then it's probably an additional half day doing admin stuff, like you said. Yeah.
Yeah. Sustainable.
And then I teach twice a week, so that's a week.
And then sometimes some freelance articles.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are weeks when I don't sleep a lot.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about growing the audience for just a little bit. So one more quote from your interview with Ethan. You said there would be months when I would only have like 1 or 2 new subscribers, but in the past couple months, there's been steep growth. It's so random that it seems almost accidental. You're at the whims of the internet and the Substack algorithm. None of it is merit-based. I really want to emphasize that. Substack is not a meritocracy. A lot to get into there. First, in as much as your growth hasn't been accidental and random, where have people found you? Like where are these 23,000 people coming from?
Yeah, so I'm like, when I tell you the sources, they are accidental and random. So it's often media mentions, right? Mm-hmm. So like, I know in the last week, I saw a really nice jump because Lynx was featured in a Verge newsletter and because I freelanced a story for the Wall Street Journal that named Lynx in the byline, right? A couple of weeks before that, Lynx was in a Financial Times roundup of all places. Thank you, Financial Times. I did not know we shared an audience. I have a very, very kind reader who's a columnist at The Guardian. She occasionally references Lynx. I always see a big jump after that. But these are like not things I could engineer.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe with the exception of the Wall Street Journal. I put Lynx in my bio. Yeah. but like generally speaking, I don't even know the people at these outlets are reading the newsletter until like someone forwards a screenshot to me and I'm like, awesome, today's a great day. So that has been a source of a lot of growth. You know, speaking of Rusty Foster, when he took a break from Today in Tabs, his phenomenal daily newsletter, to hike the Appalachian Trail, he very generously recommended that people look to Lynx as a replacement.
I saw a lot of traffic from that. That's awesome.
Yeah. It was really, really kind. It's actually like an extraordinary testament to his relationship with his audience. And I haven't done some like reflecting on this, but I saw a ton of people sign up for paid annual subscriptions sight unseen. Yeah. And their comment would be, Rusty recommended you. Like, I'll read anything Rusty tells me to. And I'm like, God damn.
So that actually, I want to comment on another thing you, a term I've seen you use a couple times in Lynx, where you, which is just the newsletter community. And this seems like kind of, I wanted to ask you like what that is, but you're kind of describing it right here. It's like these other writers who have been doing it for a long time and like have this journalistic integrity and like trust with their audience. What, talk to me about this like newsletter community, because it sounds like that's where it's this mutual thing where your growth comes, where your audience comes from.
Yeah, I can't claim to have any like huge visibility into the space writ large, especially as it like expands in a more and more cavernous way at all times. But like my little corner of the newsletter community, such as it exists, is so kind and free of ego and generous with support and, you know, cross links and things like that. I don't think I have ever approached another newsletter writer for like advice or help with something, or vice versa, that someone has approached me and that I have turned them down or that they have turned me down. Right. I think it's frankly very different from journalism, which can be quite sharp elbowed and quite competitive. I think there is an understanding that the pie is large enough for all of us. It's really kind of like a shine theory thing. Like you succeed, I succeed. Which is frankly like a beautiful way to work.
Yeah.
So that has been really nice. Again, that's my corner of it. Is that what everyone is like or like everywhere? I don't know. But the folks I've interacted with have always been very, very kind and very interested in each other's success.
Yeah, no, that's really nice. In as much as you have a content calendar and you're like planning what you're writing about months in advance, what is that? Are you planning these things out, or is it like, I know what I'm going to write about next month, but not in 6 months? Yeah. How are you planning your editorial slate?
So I'm so glad we talked today and not like last week, because I just did my calendar for the rest of the year.
Oh, wow.
Earlier this year. Yeah. So there was, generally speaking, I try to have rough plans for 2 months out, but inevitably like things happen that falls apart, right? So like I just did this big Gamergate series. Was, you know, 4 weeks, like almost a month, and that took up so much of my mental energy, and I had other freelance things going on, that I had nothing planned for the end of the Gamergate series. Right, so like the end of the series came and I'm just shit, you know. So it was very important to me to like actually get a calendar together and know what I'm doing for the next couple months. I just do that in Google Sheets. I don't have like a fancy editorial tool or anything like that.
No ClickUp around here.
No, why don't you? What is that? I don't even know what that is.
You don't need to know. You don't need to know.
No, it's all good. We are very much a Google household. Had my Chromebook technical troubles. GChat in the name. I just plan it out in Google Sheets. Inevitably it will change as things come up, but I find that that's a good time span, you know, kind of see like what's coming down the pike in terms of like what books are coming out that like their authors might be good guests for like a Lynx interview, or you know, are there any tentpole events or like holidays or anything that I might want to plan content around. So God, I hate hearing myself use the term content. I do not like the term content, but it is also filtered in my subconscious like everyone else's.
We swim in
the swamp.
Yeah, there we go.
If you can swim on a swamp. Yeah, so that's where I'm at. How far how far in advance do you plan out?
Next question. It's I need to get better at that. No, sometimes I have like a month of interviews scheduled. Sometimes I'm like I'm not as caught up, and it's like so this interview will come out in 2 weeks. So 2 weeks from Friday. I need to get much better at that. It's like, yeah. Anyways, next question. No, I think so.
It's
the problem
hard.
With me too. Yeah, because with me too, it's like I want to like it's fully interview based, and I want to interview people who have different stories. Like I try to my mantra that I don't always stick to is like consistent but not predictable, right? So I want people who like are coming from different backgrounds. Like I'm going to talk to you, so maybe next week I want to talk to somebody who's more of like a hustle creator type, you know, somebody who has like a huge audience, somebody who has a small. So, that's really hard because I also have to do the outreach to the people and get them to agree to an interview and then schedule it. But you don't want to be scheduled too far in advance. So basically it's I need to do what you did yesterday or whatever and sit down and like plan the rest of the year. And like, yeah, not as far in advance as I'd like. But so speaking of books really quickly, I did look at your Goodreads because you link it on your personal website. it's right there in the footer of your personal website. No, we're gonna be very erudite here. Like a month
ago, shit, what's the last book I read?
No, a month ago, you read a book that a friend of mine, my old boss, actually had recommended to me, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about it. It's called, I'll read the full title for the listeners. It is Black Pill: How I Witnessed the Darkest Corners of the Internet Come to Life, Poison Society, and Capture American Politics. It's by L. Reeve. So a little break from talking about the newsletter. Tell me about this book. Should I read it? What's the vibe?
It's a phenomenal book. I'm like, do I have it on my desk? I think I've shelved it by now. So I read that book and I interviewed Elle for the newsletter.
Yeah.
I don't know how familiar you are with her work. I find her to be like journalistically like an interview savant, right? Mm-hmm. She can get information out of people that is in no way in their best interest to reveal. Like it's just fascinating to watch her work. And of course, most of her work is as a video journalist. So you can watch her work. She's on camera. So this book was about all of the reporting that she has done on the rise of the alt-right.
Mm-hmm.
And again, for reasons that would like be unclear to your standard observer, a lot of these guys have like really gotten close with her and like really spilled their guts to her though it is not in their best interest. So I thought it was a fascinating book. I thought it's dark. It's not like a fun read. You get that from the title, right?
I'm currently reading John Gans's When the Clock Broke, with the rise of con men in the 90s in America, whatever it is. And yeah, anyways, so.
This might be up your alley. It helped unify a lot of threads for me. But at the end of the day, it was most interesting to me because like as a journalist I'm interested in other people's technique and some of the things she said about her interview technique I was like, this is wild, this is a crazy thing to read about.
I need to get into that. Okay, I guess we should go back to the newsletter for a second. I want to talk about Substack as like an ecosystem for a second. I didn't start thinking about this until like I started thinking more about the newsletter ecosystem at the beginning of this year. I just thought of it as like another tool for newsletters like any other, but I feel like with the introducing the social media tools, etc., and like with the funding with their business model where they like take a cut of paid subscriptions, I feel like Substack is almost more of a media company and a magazine, the Uber for posts, than it is like you know, Beehive, Ghost, MailChimp, any of these other tools. Like that's a tool, whereas Substack, you are almost like an Uber driver style, not even a freelancer, but an Uber driver style writer for this media company. Do you agree with that? Does that make sense?
Like, is this a pitch for Beehive?
Well, in a way, yes, it is. Ultimately, but I don't know. Like, does that make sense? Or am I just like, you know, Beehive pilled over here?
No, you are absolutely correct. I am continuously disappointed and annoyed by the changes that Substack is making to their core product. I think they very transparently want, I mean, the whole model of newsletters is that you own your audience, right?
Yeah.
And Substack very obviously wants to claw as much of that audience as they can away from you and into their standalone app, where now they're layering all these other social features
and
in.
And then the audience is paying for other people's newsletters. So, yeah.
Exactly. I think it is a betrayal of the core promise of Substack.
Yeah.
I think it is to the detriment of people who primarily are there to write, which was, again, their original promise. And it's something that I think, you know, long term for me makes me question if I'm going to be on that platform forever. But for better or worse, Substack does also offer some features and some benefits that are very compelling. Some of which do have to do with that ecosystem that they're building, right?
If I can interject for a second, I think part of it is like what I understand about them, like whereas, you know, a Beehive, et cetera, is like a publishing tool and more purely a publishing tool. It's like you're just creating a product though that you really then have to think about going out and marketing. Like, yeah, there's growth tools there as well, but like Substack is like more aggressively pushing, you know, one newsletter audience into another. So like I see the appeal for somebody like you who comes from like the more journalistic background and doesn't want to think of it as like content and doesn't want to think of like the strategy and like, you know, your readers as audience. It's then appealing to like not have to think about that, and they kind of like run the business for you, and you are like, it again, it's the Uber model where like you don't have to think about like finding somebody to like give you a call when they need a taxi, right? Like that's the appeal.
And you're exactly right. Like, that works for me now in like the stage of growth that I'm at and the capacity that I have. I mean, when, you know, knock on wood, if and when I'm able to replace my full prior salary with Substack, and we can talk about like,
you'll be well beyond it by this time next year. Anyways,
you know, from your mouth to God's ears, Francis. Should I get to that point where I can maybe afford to hire like a freelancer to help out with some things around the edges? Okay, well then, like, there's no incentive for me to stay on Substack anymore. But right now, when it's taking up all my time just to write the damn thing, like, I do not have the capacity to also write the Instagrams. I'm just on Instagram to like people's dog photos, right?
So wait, so this is something the co-host of the other podcast I do, Daisy, who runs Dirt. We are, by the time this comes out, this episode will have already been out. So listener, go listen to it. It's out. But next week, we're planning on talking about reinventing the magazine. This is kind of a topic that she wants to talk about, but I think it's very relevant to what we're talking about here, where like, I think for many indie newsletterists, whatever, people trying to like make it in this way, it's like, do you have to reinvent the magazine? Like, do you have to like partner up with like other writers and like, you know, pool resources for distribution, pool audience, pool, like, you know, subscription revenue. Because that, again, I think like in a way that's what Substack is at a larger scale. But yeah, I think this flow of like indie to like, wait, actually, should we organize again? Which could be in an indie way, like with any of these, with Beehive, with Ghost, whatever. 404 Media is a great example of this on Ghost. I like them a lot. Yeah, I don't know. Is it just the pendulum going towards reinventing the magazine? And magazine just meaning like an organization of both creatives and business people.
That's interesting. I guess my gut feeling when I hear you say reinventing the magazine is like, well, the glory of magazines was that they were so like glossy and hi-fi.
Yeah.
And what we're talking about now is
I'm probably butchering it probably in the way that Daisy meant, because I'll talk to her about it next week on our podcast and I'll figure out what she means. But what I mean, probably she means more that glossy bit. But yeah, just the like the pooling of resources. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're on to something. I mean, I was talking to several other newsletter creators when I was at ONA, and you tend to hear the same things over and over again. I mean, like, the number one thing is that this is lonely, is that you miss having colleagues, you miss having a community.
Somebody to like push you, criticize you, edit your work.
Exactly. Exactly. So I wouldn't be surprised to see the rise of sort of newsletter collectives or more formalized arrangements, whether social or business, you know, between newsletters in the future. Just because, I mean, as newsletters mature and people kind of grow out of like, this is a fun thing I did for the couple years, now it's my whole career. Okay, well, now I need to put the infrastructure in place that I like feel good doing this all the time. And inevitably that involves working with other humans, right?
Yeah.
For most people, for many people.
Yeah. Or, you know, AI agents. We don't have to go there.
Oh, no.
That was a joke. Okay. I only have a couple more questions though. One, so there's so many aggregation newsletters now. These publishing tools becoming more accessible have given rise to that. You are one of the more enduring aggregation newsletters. I don't know. I think it's hard to like do this style of newsletter in a way that like is actually interesting and valuable to people, as opposed to like, what did I read this morning? Let me put the best three links in a newsletter and send it out to people. Like, people maybe aren't going to care. There's too many of them. I don't know how, like, for you, it's like, this is like the art of curating link. Not that that's all, you write the essays too, et cetera, but this art of like curating links, the craft of curating links, you've got this RSS feed that you've been working on for like a decade. In as much as like you can make something like this good and not just like a self-indulgent, you know, thing that nobody wants to read, like, what are you thinking about when you're selecting these links? Like, how, I don't know, what's the craft of making an aggregation newsletter?
Yeah, I think it probably varies, but for me, I mean, I do encounter a lot of the newsletters of the type you're describing that it's like, here's what I read this week. Yeah. And I'm like, I have no interest in like what you read this
week. Where's the thread?
I don't mean you personally.
Yeah. No, it's okay.
It's like I
read crap.
Because I don't know. I don't know like what your news diet is, and I don't know what your preferences are and things like that. I mean, my approach, like what I hope differentiates my approach, is that I'm like extremely rigorous and comprehensive in the news that I consume. It's just about like every mainstream outlet in the US, Canada, and the UK that you can think of.
Mm-hmm.
Like plus dozens of newsletters and tech outlets. That would be difficult to quantify.
Is it like wake up, coffee, you know, you're reading for 3 hours and then you write?
No, it's not. So I spend a lot of time, going through the feeds, which is, you know, like that's just headlines. So like I spend a lot of hours doing that. In terms of what I actually read, it's probably like 8 hours or so a week. I'm a pretty fast reader. I'm a very slow writer, but I'm a fast reader. That's like if I was slow at both, this would never work. absolutely never work. It's called links I would G-chat you if we were friends, but it's like, it's not necessarily my personal taste.
It is
based on like a rigorous survey of the news landscape. And I think that differentiates it from like, here's a funny thing I saw on Twitter. And I'm like, that's haphazard and algorithmic. Yeah. And is it the best thing out there? I don't know. Cause I don't know that you read everything that's out there. And like, that's the gap I'm trying to fill. I don't know if that answered your question.
No, that definitely does. Okay. So we touched a little bit on this earlier, but you used to write a column. I think this was at the Post, called What Was Fake on the Internet This Week. And you did it for 82 weeks straight. And on the occasion of the final column, so in December 2015, you wrote, since then, referring to when you started, these sorts of rumors and pranks haven't slowed down exactly, but the pace and tenor of fake news has changed. Where debunking an internet fake once involved some research, it's now often as simple as clicking around for an about or disclaimer page, which then brought to mind, you wrote these words like a decade ago, right? But I think quite a bit has changed. A lot has, you know, stayed the same. Introduction of AI slop is one of those things that has definitely changed. Max Reed had a great article about it in New York Mag today, I think, in Intelligencer. Anyways, could that column exist today? Why or why not? Or what would you have to change about it?
Absolutely not. You know why that column couldn't exist today? Because it no longer matters if you tell people what's fake and what's real. I mean, that's the reality, right? So I was at this really interesting is overselling it. It was very technical and like sometimes esoteric.
You were interested.
Panel at ONA where they were talking about like all these technologies that exist now that like embed in the metadata of a photo the origins of that photo, right? So this technology exists, and it is present already. It is in our cameras and our phones in many cases already, that can tell you whether a photo is real or fake. But to some extent, it doesn't even matter, because when people want to believe a photo is real, when it's not, there is no authority that can tell them, oh, the metadata says this, that they'll believe, yeah. Right? And I think I was starting to get that towards the end of that column. You know, we've had many, many studies show that debunking misinformation often just makes people believe it more strongly than they did before the debunk.
Oh, you have an agenda. This is real. Like, I could debunk your agenda too. Yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, like, frankly, I feel bad for people who are employed full-time as fact-checkers. especially leading up to the election. Because the work that they're doing is so important and also just like possibly so irrelevant. I don't know. Like, but, you know, as I'm not sure that's changing hearts and minds. And that's true on the right and the left, right? Mm-hmm. So that column sounds fantastically naive now. And for good reason, it cannot possibly exist, right?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I don't think we've come up with like a good solution to addressing that, certainly not from the news media side. Just a little depressing.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's why we have tote bags that say media literacy is sexy.
app was pitched to me as like a solution to misinformation. And I was,
what?
I was kind of like, I don't know if you know a lot about misinformation.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't have any more questions. Is there anything we should have touched on that you want to touch on before?
No,
we go?
This one's amazingly and terrifyingly thorough.
Good. Look, you know, that's exactly what I want to hear. Where should people go to find your work?
Well, naturally, please go to links. It is linksiwouldgchatyou.substack.com.
Go and sign up for a paid subscription so she can replace that Buffalo News salary. We'll get there by the end of the year. Knock on wood. I'm knocking on wood. I don't know if you can hear it in the audio. But this has been the Creator Spotlight Podcast. I have been Francis Zier, and our guest today has been Caitlin Dewey. I'll see you next week. Thank you.